Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hello and welcome to a very special Caged In conversation, as ever, brought to you by the Breadcrumbs Collective and hosted by me, Petros Patsilivas. This week on the podcast, we have a very special guest in the form of Dan Fogler. It was an absolute joy to pick his brain all about playing the main man himself, Francis Ford Coppola, in Paramount Plus's limited series, The Offer, which me and Will Chich have been covering week by week here on the podcast. And from next week, that's going to be taking full focus. No longer going to be Friday bonuses up until the end of the season. We've got episodes 8, 9 and 10 left to cover. They're going to be just your regular Tuesday episodes. And we're going to do a nice little wrap-up episode, kind of talk about our overall thoughts with that. So if you're not watching The Offer, now is your time to watch it, get involved. It's been a lot of fun. And I think this little season we've been doing deserves its own shine. As for this conversation, it's absolutely joyous. I'm going to tell you right now, if you're here for Fantastic Beasts chat, We don't do it. I was aware that my time with Dan might be slightly limited, so I made the conversation very, very, very offer-centric. And we kind of, we really get into the weeds on it. We really get into what it was like playing Francis Ford Coppola, what it was like being on this show and seeing these recreations of these really famous sets and costumes and we get into all of that. We get into the critical reception of this show. Obviously, critics haven't been the kindest to this show. And we ask the question why. And it's kind of fascinating to ask a question like that with one of the stars of the show who has some big opinions on it. And I've got to say, as you're hearing the conversation, I agree with Dan on those points. And I'd like to say up front a massive thanks to Dan for his time. He really didn't have to do this, but I don't know. I just found that he's a guy who loves what he does. And it was, he carved out an hour of his time. So I'm going to step away and let you enjoy this conversation with the one, the only, Dan Fogler. Today, I have the pleasure of being joined by a Tony Award-winning actor, podcaster, comic book creator, and writer who you may know from such films as Balls of Fury, Fanboys, the Fantastic Beast films, The Walking Dead, or playing Francis Ford Coppola in The Offer, to name but a few of his credits. Ladies and gentlemen, Dan Fogler. How are you today, Dan?
Hey man, never cut off the applause. If they want to keep applauding, that's That's fine by me.
Yeah, that's a rule to live by, right? If there's going to be applause, take them. Relish
take the applause. Yes.
So I guess, yeah, the main reason I wanted to speak to you today, obviously you've got this illustrious career, as I said, a Tony Award winner. Like, so is it right in saying that the stage was like your first love when it came to acting? What was the kind of, I don't know, yeah, what was the early years like, and when did you, I don't know, what made you want to get into acting, I guess?
Yeah, my introduction was school plays and stuff like that, and school musicals. And I mean, I always loved watching television and watching movies, and my parents would take me to Broadway and stuff like that. And so I think that, I think if my first gateway was TV, I would have probably gone that way, but it was theater. That's what was most accessible. So that's what I knew, which was good. It was really good training in the theater, man. It's like, I strongly recommend, if you're going to become an actor, to do that. It's kind of like, you gain a lot of skills like you would like on like a pirate ship or like, you know, like a sailing ship, you know, you learn how to do certain things that come in handy along the way.
I guess like that, not monotony, but doing the same thing day in, day out. And you get to ride those rough waves, right? Like you've kind of got the audience right there in front of you. So it's not a case of like, let's do another take. It is the case of let's roll with the waves of how the show is going on the night, right?
Yeah, you hone a lot of skills walking that tightrope, and so you yeah. I mean, it's priceless, really, as an actor, to be able to maintain that character, become an expert at the character, maintain that kind of stamina and endurance and energy every single night, to be able to, you know, recreate before everybody's eyes something that when you have, you don't have, you only have one take at it. Yeah. And so that's really quite exciting. And if you do mess up, then you got to hone the skills of improvisation, which is also really helpful. Yeah. So, you know, it really comes in handy. And you just to be in front of people, is something really special, like that audience interaction. When it's going well and you're kind of riding that, the wave of laughter or whatever, or you can hear a pin drop, there's nothing like that. That's like the best. And that translates into, like, I still use those skills while I'm on set. So like if I'm on set and I'm trying to gauge how things are going, I'll use the crew as like my mini audience, you know, everyone standing around the character, everyone standing around the camera. I feel if they're kind of holding in giggles, like I know it's funny. And if they're like really listening, and like, they'll tell you, they'll come up after and just be like, that was great. You know, like, you know, so it's good. All those skills, I would never change a thing about my training.
I guess with the theater as well, you get a chance to, I guess the way to put it is understand like the internal workings of a character. Have you found that is something that you've taken to like your screen work, kind of like really developing the characters you're playing?
Yeah, absolutely. Everything I learned in creating characters, like some characters, you can really pull from your own life. And that's what I usually do. Like that's like Uta Hagen stuff, you know, like that's one of the first acting books I ever read, where you are acting with somebody, you don't really know them, but you take from your own life, oh, who does this person remind you of? That person that, you know, was my, you know, friend or girlfriend or, you know, whatever. And you project that onto them, and then suddenly, in an instant, you have, you know, 20-year relationship with them, And that's suddenly, that's like instant chemistry that you can come up with. So usually the characters that I play start from, oh, how is this person like me? And then I kind of find something or stories that happened to me or people that I knew, and I grow characters out of that. Sometimes, like very in a very theatrical way, sometimes it's just a hat, you know, sometimes it's just shoes or a mustache, you know. Mm-hmm. Like for Jacob, even though I had a tremendous amount in common with Jacob Kowalski, it wasn't until I had the mustache I was like, oh, there he is, you know, that's that that iconic, you know,
which
Baker look.
It's fascinating because I, when like, yeah, I've researched like the making of The Godfather myself and like combed through loads of books. And I think it's in Mark Seale's great book, Leave the Gun, Take the Cannoli. And he kind of says how Coppola would get trinkets for people to kind of like put this in your pocket, have this lighter and like just to try. And obviously a guy who was all about actors, as we kind of see throughout The Offer, it's like there's that great, well, those scenes between yourself and like Gordy Willis, like the kind of butting heads of like the look of it versus the actors doing their job. And I find that fascinating, finding those details to make a performance something special. It's great to hear that that's something you draw upon as well.
Yeah, Coppola was legendary for those little quirks because he comes from the theater.
Yes.
And so I think that you see that in his work. It's pervasive, the way he talks to the actors and relates to them.
There are those small details I picked up on in the show. Like, I think there's a scene quite early on with you and Patrick, and you're slicing out pages of the novel, which like instantly in my head is like a kind of big nerd on the on Coppola and The Godfather. It's like, oh, he's creating the kind of the famous like notebook. And like, I think there's a moment like later on in a board meeting and like you slam it down on the table. And it's obviously, if you don't know that minor detail that Coppola went through creating this kind of something he had gathered from the theater, right? This like kind of, this will do this, and kind of writing all in the margins and stuff like that. Like,
yeah, the Godfather notebook was, a part of my homework that Dexter Fletcher told me that I needed to do before we got started. And that was just genius, because what it was Coppola's theatrical training. And what you do in that situation is you take the play and you cut out all the pages, and then you put it into a larger notebook so that you can have a larger, so you have the page from the play, and then on the margins you have place so you can write, and you tape all of those and you paste all of those pages. And I love that he did this, and he pastes all the pages from his play, which was the novel The Godfather, and he puts it into this enormous notebook, and he has these giant pages with the novel pages at the center, and all around the novel pages are his anxieties and his notes and, you know, all of his little tidbits of like, how the hell am I going to do this scene? And having those, it's literally like a microscope into his brain of exactly what he was thinking for those scenes in that moment. I was like, oh my God, this is like the keys to his psyche. Which was really, obviously really helpful to have that notebook. And that came, he did that because, you know, this was a big job. This was a big thing. And he said, okay, I'm going to do what I do, as a director, in these situations. And it's incredible that he chopped up all of, that's a big book, man. That's a big novel, The Godfather. That's a lot of pages.
And that's two copies, right? Because obviously you've got you can't have, yeah, you can't flip over the page. Like, do you know what I mean? You have to have two copies, so it's on one sided. Do you know what I mean? If that makes sense.
Oh, right. I see what you're saying. Yeah.
So it becomes even larger.
Well, he did it where you have the, you know, the front of the page of the book and the back of the page of the book, and you just,
Oh, you cut a hole in the middle,
of a big old page.
I get it. Yeah.
So, and then if you watch the show, he holds on to that for all of the shooting. That's like his Bible. He says that he rarely looked to the script. That whenever he was referencing his shots, he always looked in that gigantic, you know, sandwich of a notebook. And that was a great prop to have around. That was his, like, his shield, you know, walking into those producer meetings. And he could kind of, you know, if things were going not going well, he could kind of hide behind it. Or if he was upset, he could smash it down, you know. That was a great prop, man. And yeah, I strongly recommend just getting that book. If you love The Godfather, you see what was on Coppola's mind on every single, in every single scene, which is genius.
So yeah. You said that obviously you normally try and look for a similarity, like with a character. How was it different? Because am I right in thinking this is the first like true life person you've played like on screen? How was that different? Is that a different, like, what was the in?
Like someone who's living.
I mean, somebody who has been alive.
I just realized this is the most, I guess, major one. Mm-hmm. I did do it before in a movie called Taking Woodstock.
Yes.
Where I played this guy called Devin, who was one of the Earthlight, the leader of the Earthlight players. And that was easy, man. I just had to do like theater exercises, you know. Coppola was kind of daunting, but there were moments of like where I was instilled with like confidence, where it was in the audition. I if you told me, okay, you're gonna audition for Coppola, I was like, I'd be like, okay, really. That's awesome. But then when I was doing the audition and I put the glasses on and I put my hair to the side and I had the beard and I was like, oh man, I kind of look like him, you know? And so that was helpful. Just knowing that it wasn't hard to look like him. And then where he was in his life at the time and where he was in his career, I understood that. Mm-hmm. I understood where he was hungry. He wanted to prove himself. He was, he had gained notoriety and as a writer, but not as a director. And so he was in this kind of limbo, and I've been there, man. I've been in that place where I'm just like, just give me a shot, you know, let me just get in the room and being in a situation where he has this idea, but he's the youngest guy in the room in a lot of situations. So it's even harder for him for people to trust his vision, you know, and oh, what a battle, like what a great part to play. I understood a lot about what he was going through at the time, or at least I was able to project my own, you know, past woes in my career. And so I got that, you know, and there was also, I've been watching Coppola since I'm 15. Yes. Like that's when I saw Hearts of Darkness. And I was like, who is this lunatic making this in a movie? Like who is this ringleader at the middle of all of these incredible performers and recreating a war, like an entire war, you know? And so right away, just watching him and just being like, oh, he kind of reminds me of like an uncle of mine, or, or he reminds me of like, because he and my dad are from, you know, similar regions in New York. And so my dad kind of sounds like him. And so watching him, it was almost like I was watching someone from the neighborhood or someone from my family. So Coppola has been felt very familiar to me since the beginning. And then there's certain things, you know, like getting into those outfits. Uh-huh. And
yeah, like especially I was kind of waiting for the premiere of The Godfather just to see you walk down in that bright orange suit, like the velvet fog.
Velvet and corduroy and corduroy and velvet, man. Yeah, that velvet orange suit. I had a velvet one. I also had a blue one, I think. For the Oscars, I had a blue velvet tuxedo. That orange suit was, not a lot of people could pull that off, you know, but it just like cemented in the time period in such a great way. Like that's so 70s, you know, and it's so ballsy. Like Coppola, who I'm pretty convinced that he has a lot of fears, and he faces those fears by swinging the pendulum toward the other side, you know. Yeah. He's like, oh my gosh, we're going to this event, everyone's going to be like judging my film, oh my god, I have a lot riding on this, I just want to hide, no, I'm going to wear a shiny orange outfit, you know. You can't hide, you know, and that's, it takes an interesting ego to wear something like that.
Exactly. What I find fascinating about this, and obviously you've stepped into like the wizarding world, and like you came into The Walking Dead at a later stage. Were the kind of those have like inbuilt audiences and like a level of expectation? Was there like a different kind of pressure, like when it came to playing Francis Ford Coppola? Because obviously there would be, did you know that there would be eyes on this project, like a lot of eyes and a lot of kind of like, do you know what I mean, people? I don't know.
Yeah, I mean,
scrutinizing everything like that you were doing. Yeah. Was it like what was that feeling like?
Yeah, it's kind of like you have to let go and just have fun, or else you're just gonna go nuts.
Yes.
Scrutinizing every little bip and boop you do. I had Dexter Fletcher was just a huge really a huge help for boosting confidence. Right away, first just rehearsals, really, he was like, you've got it, mate, you're him mate, and just like, all right, I guess I'm him, man. You know, and he like hypnotized me into believing I was him, and I really felt like I got his essence, you know. Mm-hmm. and my god, surrounded by those performances, like someone like Matthew Good.
I can only fathom what it would have been like on set to see him go full Bob Evans.
So I call him the time machine, because there were moments where he'd be talking and I would have an out-of-body experience. Like I would be in my POV and I would see, you know, Coppola's glasses and Coppola's hands and Coppola's, you know, notebook. And there's Evans just being Bob Evans, baby. And they're just being like, whoa. And then like seeing the Paramount sign and everyone perfectly dressed in the period. There were moments where I almost forgot my lines, because I was like, whoa, we are here, man. I think it's hard to do that. And sometimes you're feeling it and, you know, but, I really feel like there, like when in the recreation of all of these certain things, we didn't do it all the time, but when we did do it, it was pretty magical.
Mm. I was going to ask about that, because one of the things me and my co-host Will, when we've been talking about The Offer, we're constantly saying like the recreations of like some of the sets and the locations from the film. What was it like being on there? Obviously, you said you've grown up with Coppola since you were 15. Was it kind of feeling like you're, I don't know, was it a weird feeling to walk onto like something that you probably, I imagine you've probably seen countless amounts of times.
Well, growing up watching Coppola and watching The Godfather, and anytime there was any recreation of the smallest little thing, everyone who was a fan would just be like, oh, You know, they would have a, just a little, you know, this warm, nostalgic feeling in their heart of, I mean, the smallest thing where it was just like, you know, the guys, just the guys waiting on the steps. I think just even a fraction of this made it into the show. But for me, when I first saw that, I was like, whoa, this guy really looks like Enzo the baker being, you know, put up there to look like a hitman. And in that scene where they're protecting his father in the hospital, that's such an emotional, powerful scene. And then for the guy to like, suddenly I'm standing there. I'm just like, yeah, I'm acting like Coppola. I turn around and suddenly there Enzo walks up, you know, out of the mist. And I'm just like, holy crap, I'm in the movie. Like, what the hell's happening? Intense, man. I mean, that's just something that's tiny.
Yes.
Seeing being in Brando's, you know, office, inner sanctum. That was like,
yeah, that's,
I'm glad.
That's something
I felt like I was in a dream.
Yeah. That's like Patrick said. He said that day felt very special, just like kind of being the small group of you with Miles Teller and Juno Temple and Justin Chambers. Like,
there was,
it felt really magic that day.
I'm talking about when he's already the Don and we're in his office, you know. But Patrick, love Patrick. We had that brilliant scene which is like a legendary scene, where they really went to Brando's house to convince him to do the movie. And Coppola took his like little 16mm camera or whatever and filmed him. And Brando was in like a kimono with like blonde hair and did not look like the Don. And then Brando, the genius, you know, theatrical actor, was like,
give me some shoe polish and some cotton balls for my jowls.
You know, and then the next thing you know, Brando transforms into the Don behind them. And that's a famous like story. Oh, yeah. And we recreated that moment, which was really quite magical. But I'm talking about any time we recreated moments from the actual movie.
Yeah.
Was really surreal. Very special. Like we recreated, like on the cover of the Godfather notebook, there's a picture of Coppola leaning over Brando while Brando's in the tuxedo and he's got the cat. And they're in the office there. And I said, we got to recreate that moment. And that's that moment is in the show where I'm leaning over him and I'm saying, so how do you feel about it? And I'm like, you want to try another one? And so that was, I was like, I love that. I love that we did that. And I think my favorite one that we recreated was the one where, Sonny beats up Carlo. Yes. because there were just so many different overlaps of Sonny getting justice for his sister, but he's also getting justice for my sister.
Yeah.
You know, I loved all that. And then me and Miles and our little, like, you know, our little undercover action there was, I love that, man. I love that bit. It makes me smile.
There's the little line as well, I think, about like the authenticity of like the fire hydrant and stuff like that, which is obviously like, if you're a fan of The Godfather, it's like you just kind of always remember that like spraying fire hydrant in that scene. And just, I don't know, I think the show does it really well. And you see the setups of these shots. And like, I'm always like, because I don't know how you would have felt like being in it, but obviously watching it, you're almost like hesitant of, and I imagine it's obviously a choice by the makers of like, we're not going to show you recreations of these scenes because that's almost like sacrilege. But like, just to see the reactions from people is, and I think, I don't know, that's a lot of what you get to do in this show, right? Is like, there's a lot of just reaction shots of, and
using those scenes as an emotional backdrop to the story of how they made this movie. You know, that's basically what we did.
Yeah, which I always love those moments because it's, I don't know, it's that classic thing of it's what you're not seeing and you're imagining going on as well. It's kind of that plays as much as a part of what you are seeing at the same time, and it kind of works in this kind of magical tandem to make you emote even more. Like, I guess a scene, yeah, that how it felt for you to do was that scene at the dinner table with the kind of the cast and Al Ruddy. Like, what was that like? Were you kind of as like you as an actor? Were you kind of as amazed and awestruck as Coppola is in that scene?
Yeah, that was also another legendary story. Mm-hmm. That we were recreating. So, you know, like, we heard about that story, and I heard about that story in college. Like, that, yeah, that bit was written about where Coppola got all the actors together and, you know, the back room of this restaurant and got real Italian food. And this was his acting exercise. And he was, Coppola is all about the sensual and getting actors to hang out together and eat together and party together, because that just made for better chemistry. Like, it's just undeniable. So this was his first version of that for The Godfather. And I guess he had done this for other theater things. And so at this dinner, and it's basically how it plays out in the show. You have Brando sit down at the table, and everybody just kind of like, you know, Jimmy Kahn, may he rest in peace, man. Oh, Jimmy sits next to him. He's like vying for his attention. And then, you know, John Cassell, he's sitting there. He's trying to like, you know, awkwardly get his attention too. Everyone's trying to like, and because of this hierarchy, it's just like, yeah, that's how they would be with their father, you know? Hey, Dad, look at me, you know? And Coppola, you know, was legendarily awestruck by it. He was just like, oh my God, it's working. It's just working. You get all these talented people together. Suddenly Michael was Michael, and I mean, you know, Pacino is just like instantly Pacino, sitting next to Diane Keaton. They're falling in love already. He's like, this is easy. You know? And so it was, that was a legendary scene that we had to recreate, that I think we pulled off really well, but you know, it's, you're walking a tightrope. You're just like, you know, we have to pay homage to this. We have to make it our own, you know, obviously. But you have such high expectations about what it is, you know. But people responded to, people love that scene. People were tweeting like crazy about it.
Did you find that, obviously being in the show, were you able to enjoy it as like a viewer? Have you watched it as well, or do you kind of keep things separately?
Yeah, I was really interested because I didn't see anything while we were doing it. I just kind of trusted them that it was going well. I usually like to see playback, you know, after each take, but I didn't see anything. And so they gave me 10 episodes, all 10, about a month before it came out. And I fell in love with it. I was like, oh my God, everyone. And it's such a pity that the Emmys just snubbed the hell out of it, because I was convinced that, you know, I was at least convinced that Matthew was going to get nominated at least, you know. I was like, Juno, I was convinced. I was convinced Miles was going to get some attention. And I was convinced that it was going to get, you know, but obviously I was wrong. But at the time I was like, this is great. I showed it to my family. I showed it to my friends. Everyone was just like, this is awesome. Yeah. And it's so funny because the reviewers had 99% of the reviewers had their heads up their asses. It's just crazy. It's like they were all paid off or something. I don't know. But the audience reviews really tell you what's going on there.
Yeah,
people freaking love it. And I always think that's, well, what do you think about that? When you have such a strange, you know, dichotomy. Like, it's just so, it's such a juxtaposition. Like, you have on one side people who are actually watching it, who we make it for, the audience, loving it. And then you have all these reviewers who are in, you know, who you think are part of respectable companies. And they just totally missed it. Like, how does that happen? They're a professional, you know?
Yeah, because obviously, yeah, I've probably spent a lot more time than a lot of people kind of dissecting each individual episode. And it's taken...
Like, how could you not find something good in it? It's like, there's something great in all of it.
And obviously, like, knowing the kind of people, as soon as you've got, like, Dexter Fletcher kind of setting the tone of what the show is, it kind of, that comes with a certain kind of, I don't know, like, you know the tone that it's he's going to be setting. And one of the things I found like wholly enjoyable about the show is the kind of the fun tone to it. And I guess the, where it might, yeah, it's something we speculated on the show is obviously people within, especially a lot of like film critics have got involved in the conversation is, because of the nature of what the show is about, and it's obviously a film that is held up so high, and there is so much about it, and people kind of know the internal workings, that they get too caught up on the, well, actually, it didn't happen exactly like that. And I'm kind of, like yourself, baffled about why it's kind of got this disconnect. And yeah, the audiences seem to love it, and I'm not sure if that is a thing of people taking it on face value for an entertaining show about something they don't know. Whereas maybe the press, if they're kind of embedded into knowing about the machinations of how The Godfather was actually made, get caught up on all the small details to kind of just enjoy it for the fun show that it is. Yeah, that's my kind of take on it. Well, I guess, yeah, we talked about Dexter Fletcher there. Obviously, he did set the tone, but kind of, and it's interesting because you have Adam Arkin there, and how was it that difference between working with those two who are actors themselves, and then obviously you've got kind of acclaimed, seasoned pros, kind of TV directing in Gwyneth Horder-Payton and Colin Buxey. Like, how was the difference in those episodes, or was it a kind of a nice fluid thing?
No, everyone's got their own style, you know. Dexter is like a one man circus, basically. Like, he's pumping up everybody's egos, and he's calling the shots. And he's walking up and he's given great actors, director direction. And then he's walking back to the camera and like making all the extras laugh on the way back to the camera. And just setting a really fun, exciting tone. Adam Arkin, he directed the most episodes, you know. He is part of Hollywood royalty, you know, really knows,
and I guess
how great performances.
And he maybe would have had like, well, could have got some, well, firsthand like experience of that time. Because I believe he was acting even from around like 72 in a couple of things. But then obviously like, he could have easily spoke to his dad about like, and probably would have throughout the years known what it was like in Hollywood at that time as well. Did that kind of come into play at all? Did were the discussions had like kind of, or did it just come through naturally in the way he directed you that there was like, I don't know, this legacy?
I love the scenes that I love the, like he was really cool with, the, you know, dialogue scenes, like the intimate two person, like I love the scenes with me and Puzo, and it's like the brainstorming scenes, which is my favorite, probably my favorite bits, because that's what I think it's all about. Mm-hmm. The scene where Coppola is talking to Puzo and saying, no, you wrote great characters. You got to trust yourself, man. This is like, it's like you're suddenly there, you know? It's like you're there. And that's what was really important for me, at least, to recreate. And those are Adam's first directing scenes. And I thought those scenes were great where you see Coppola in real time think of a great idea.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And he takes Puzo's foundation of brilliance and says, ooh, let me run with this. And then comes up with a moment that is iconic.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I think the holding on to the gun. And during just that little moment, Michael holds on to the gun too long when he kills Salazzo McCluskey. And everyone remembers that. Everyone's watching the movie and it's like, why is he holding on to the gun? Drop the gun. You know? But I thought it was so important for the audience to see those moments because that's real, man. That's how people come up with these scripts. Two people sitting there bouncing off ideas from each other and someone has a spark of genius. Like, you got to see that spark of genius. I thought it was really important to recreate that.
So obviously those scenes between, you and Patrick as Francis and Puzo, that's something we talk about on the shows, like how special they are, and kind of as the season progresses and Patrick, like, kind of as it happened when the film was made, kind of wasn't about anymore. Kind of both of us are kind of a bit heartbroken, like, oh no, we don't get more of these scenes. But you guys had a kind of unique experience in the fact that you ended up living together. Can you tell us about that experience and how that came to be?
Yeah, in the vein of Coppola saying, you know, the actors should hang out together, from the first rehearsal I walked in and I saw him sitting there, and I projected onto him, oh, this is a guy I grew up with in the neighborhood, because he is kind of like that guy. And I was talking to him, just gave him a big hug as soon as I saw him. and he was saying, you know, he got the part last minute and he came out to LA and he was just like going with the flow and still looking for a place. And I was like, well, I got this place that I'm renting, and, you know, my family, my wife and kids were, I had like 3 weeks or like a month before they were going to come out and be with me. Cause I thought that was also like a Coppola thing, you know, he would have his family around with him. So I was like, I got some time before they get here. Do you want, I got an extra room. You want to, you know, be roomies. And I thought that was genius because Coppola and Puzo spent a lot of time together writing The Godfather. And I thought, yeah, man, we should do that in the vein of the, you know, classic method actors. And so we hung out, we partied, we tried to, you know, improvise as our characters as much as possible. And we had a blast, man. And it shows, like, the chemistry is real. Like, when you see Juno and Miles, you know, Betty and Ruddy, and they're just like, whoa, they're like an old married couple, the way they're, you know, just like chatting away there. And I was like, okay, if that's what it says in the script, then we got to act like we're just like best pals from the start. And so that's what we did.
It gives me a chance to say, like, Juno Temple is, she's something else, right? Like, kind of,
yeah, I love
her. She's amazing. And there's kind of, I think with this and Ted Lasso kind of has
built
a niche for herself as being like the woman who's sorting men's shit out, basically. Do you know what I mean? Like, she's kind of on that show, keeping...
Well, you know, in Ted Lasso, she really gets to show this very sensitive side. And that's... I feel like that character is very close to her personality. You know, the dial is turned up a little bit. But... I think that's, you know, Keely is very close to her. Betty is also close to her in a different way, but obviously Betty's American, and I loved every moment of playing with Juno. She's become a great friend. Yeah, she's just like one of those people that lights up a room, you know. Mm-hmm. And she really makes you feel comfortable. Mm-hmm. But she is so, she's very disarming and she's very charming. But she also is just like, no bullshit, you know. Mm-hmm. We're here to work. Like, this is the fun, working, you know.
Yeah. That comes across as like great scenes where there's kind of what we've coined as the gang kind of hanging out, whether it's like bar scenes and stuff like that. And they're always a joy to
me. Oh, how great is she in that scene where she's wasted at the bar and she's just calling Lapinus yes. over and over again?
Yeah. I love that kind of whole set piece because we kind of follow her throughout the bar and then kind of dip into different people's conversations. Yeah, that's a
love that
standout moment in the
We're show. Going to Sicily. Love that, man.
One of the things I particularly love about the whole, because obviously that is a big thrust of the show, is will they go to Sicily? Where were those Sicily scenes shot, Dan? Can you shed some light on that?
Oh, we were all, it was just like all in California, man. We were like near like Malibu and, you know, it's terrible.
I love it.
It's amazing how like some of those places, it really looks like like a little villa, you know, it's amazing. You know, they've been shooting movies and westerns and crazy, you know, stuff around up in California for years. So they got all those places mapped out, but it was sad. We were supposed to go to Sicily. Actually go to Sicily. And then it was like, ooh, we're going to the Canary Islands. And then it was like, actually, earthquake, so we're going to stay here. It was like, oh, okay.
So you had that real life kind of turmoil of will we get to Sicily or not as well. You got to go record on that as well.
That's
perfect. Well, kind of as the show ends, we see like, yeah, Coppola and Puzo pitching part two, and like Coppola's on like a high of, infused for what the future brings. Obviously, there probably won't be a second season of this because I imagine, well, there's not a lot of drama that went on with part two, right? It kind of seemed like, there doesn't seem to be the wealth of books and kind of material on part two. But if there were, would you come back to the character of Francis Coppola?
Absolutely. I would love to play again. I think that, it's tough to do a part two because unless Paramount takes it from Al Ruddy and they're just like, all right, we're going to do our own story of part two because Al steps away from part two. Which is like, what? Yes. But he steps away to do his own thing.
I guess Michael Tolkien has to have a chat with Fred Roos or someone, somebody who is a producer on that one instead.
I think there are tons of stories to tell about part two. There are a million stories to tell. Those would be great, obviously incredible scenes to do. The backdrop, have emotional backdrop to the story. Get De Niro infusion, like holy crap. I think there's a lot of potential. And they did, so if you started to go into part two and after a little bit of Apocalypse Now, a little bit of Cotton Club, Coppola is becoming Coppola, you know, and you get a little bit of that. Evans, and he butt heads quite a bit on the Cotton Club. I think that you might squeeze out another season for sure.
Yeah.
But that's just me.
That's something I was going to ask you is like of the kind of productions that Coppola did and like returning to this character, what for you would be like the dream making of that you would love to either see or kind of be a part of like, see, yeah.
Apocalypse Now.
Yes.
I mean, it's already Hearts of Darkness. I mean, it would be weird to to do a series with Apocalypse Now as a backdrop, but there's so many insane stories. Like, how do you top the offer? You'd have to introduce Apocalypse Now, I think.
Yeah.
And all those actors, man, like,
mm-hmm. Yeah,
Martin Sheen's heart attack, like,
yeah,
just that episode would just be like, what the fuck?
That's an episode cliffhanger, right? That's kind of like Martin Sheen's had a heart attack, like, boom, like, that's like, that kind of writes itself, or even something like, I guess. For some, it's the downturn of Coppola's career, but even the making of something like One from the Heart, which I guess is like when he had like built the dream, right? He had Zoetrope Studios, and then it was that film that kind of, it's been said on this podcast, like that it's kind of the whole 80s output is basically paying off the debt of that movie and that kind of folly. Directing from inside of a Winnebago, essentially.
Yeah,
I'm not sure how fun it would be as an actor to portray that, just sat at a kind of like control.
It's always fun. It's always fun. Be cool to see Cotton Club and just get a little Cage in there, man. That would be
yes, yeah,
right.
And
what a crazy performance from Cage in that. That's like his most insane, I think.
And I guess that would end up turning into a courtroom drama as well, right? Because Bob Evans and Francis Ford Coppola end up in court over. Who had control of that movie. So that's if there was a bookend. And
so this podcast of yours is all about, or started out as the love for the love of
Nicolas Cage.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Cool. Yeah.
Yeah. And that is, it's how do you get to know somebody? You get to know their family. So once I'd finished all his movies, I was like, let's watch all the Coppola movies. Let's kind of, however far-reaching that is, there's a fascinating thing that it even seems to be that people who marry into the family, their careers tend to change, or like, do you know what I mean? Like, I don't know, you can look at it and in the ways of Spike Jones, we always use as an example, is like he's married to Sofia Coppola, and I think there's a story that Francis was offered being John Malkovich and said, I know a guy who should direct this, and it's like, is Spike Jones to the world, or there's so many interesting kind of Jack Schwartzman as well. I think Talia Shire's second husband was an attorney and then married Talia Shire, then he was a film producer. So it's like they've kind of they're like the Corleones in the fact of they draw people into the family business, and like I don't know if they look at Spike Jones, I don't know, like probably not your place to say, but you like I'll say it, people could speculate that he's a bit of a Carlo Rizzi, and the fact that like I think Lost in Translation is based upon him as the Giovanni Ribisi character. So
oh, crazy. What did you think of Giovanni in The Offer?
I loved him. He's a favorite that we like to do impressions of every time.
And let me see.
We have an ongoing joke of like how high up are his shoulders going in each episode. That's kind of ongoing.
He did that thing where every time he sat down, he did this.
Yes. I loved it.
I loved that.
I loved it. Yeah, him and the actor playing Joe Gallo said like some of the best eye acting I've ever seen.
Oh yeah.
Like
What about Lou Ferrigno, man?
Oh, yeah. Especially when you know who he's playing as well, it's like genius casting. Like,
yeah, Luca Brasi. But come on, man. I grew up on the Hulk, on the Incredible Hulk. And then like, that was cool.
Yeah.
Because I grew up watching the Incredible Hulk, loving Lou Ferrigno, going to Comic-Cons, and then like seeing him at a Comic-Con and like getting him to like walk up to him and say to him, hey man, I've been a huge fan, you know, and just being like, oh yeah, yeah. And then being on set of The Offer and in walks Lou Ferrigno and he's looking around like for people that he recognizes, and he walks up to me, man. He freaking recognized me. Like, hey, Dad, how you doing? Like, holy crap. The Hulk recognized me. I was like, that was very special. Very special moment.
The thing I loved about him in the show is for a while he's just kind of floating around in the back of scenes as well, like it's kind of
holding up buildings.
He's kind of doesn't get a chance to like when you know he's playing Lenny Montana, you're like, oh yeah, that's perfect. But at the beginning he's like, he's just one of one of Joe Colombo's like men. It's like, what's Lou Ferrigno just doing hanging around in the back of this scene, like whilst they chat around a dinner table? Amazing, Dan. Well, I could speak to you all night, but I'm cautious of time, your time.
Yeah, I should go.
So, obviously, as well as doing acting, kind of like, you've directed in the past, you have a graphic novel, and that's one of your graphic novels, Moon Lake, is being turned into a TV show. Is that something we'll be able to see in the near future? How's the production on that going at the moment?
Yeah, thanks for bringing it up, man. I'm... Publisher is Heavy Metal, who I grew up, you know, Heavy Metal the movie, Heavy Metal magazine. Like, that's another dream come true to be able to be working with them. My books are all homages to the stuff I grew up watching. Amazing. Past my bedtime. So Heavy Metal has published Moon Lake, which is my homage to them, my homage to Twilight Zone and Tales from the Crypt. And we're making an animated show out of it with Bardell, who are the guys that do Rick and Morty. And so that's really exciting. I hope so. We just started pitching it to sell. I think there's a really good shot. We have an amazing cast. Keith David, you know, who is, Spawn and Wanda, you know, like, Phil Lamar is Samurai Jack. Like, come on. Cooper Andrews from The Walking Dead, and Allison Sudal is in it as well. She's Queenie from Fantastic Beasts. I mean, it's just the Maggie Q, like it's an all-star cast. So I think we're going to have a good shot. And then my other books, Brooklyn Gladiator and Fishkill, those are my other books with Heavy Metal. And Brooklyn Gladiator is like my sci-fi dystopian book. Blade Runner, Escape from New York style. And then Fishkill is a prequel to that, and it takes place now. And it's more of like a modern noir with a little bit of sci-fi sprinkled in. And that's Ben Templesmith is drawing that, which is really cool. Ben, Simon Beasley, man. You know Simon Beasley, who one of my favorite books was Lobo. Mm-hmm. Growing up, and Simon drew those, and he's drawing Brooklyn Gladiator, which is awesome. So if you're a fan of Simon, he does a great job with Brooklyn Gladiator. Man, I'm a kid in a candy store. I got all this all this stuff going on from when I was happening now from when I was a kid. All these things are coming full circle.
That's perfect.
It's really quite nice.
So what can we see you on the screen in next? Are we going to see you on the big screen, or is there any small screen stuff? I know it's often hard to tell people what's coming down the pipeline, but yeah.
Yeah, that's a good question, man. I am up for a couple different parts. Nothing's been solidified yet. I got a lot of interesting, like after doing Coppola, it's hard to go back and do a silly comedy, and I really want to do something special afterwards. So we're really trying to mine and find something good. There are really some good prospects. I'll be able to talk about it more probably in like a month or two. I've been getting a lot more voiceover work, which is great.
I recently took my son to the cinema for the second time, and would have heard you in DC's League of Super Pets.
Yeah, Super Pets. I did a couple voices in that, which was cool. They threw me a bone during the lockdown, man. I was like, because Fantastic Beasts shut down. And so I was like, oh my gosh, I have to pay some bills. So Warner Brothers very kindly threw me a couple voices from that. And that's always fun to... that's like my favorite thing to do, those voices, especially doing a couple different voices. That's like my jam, because like I love Mel Blanc and Looney Tunes and all that. And And it's always fun to go and take my kids and just be like, okay, see how many voices you can tell that daddy's doing. And
yeah, like
they can always pick them out. It's crazy. Sometimes I miss it. Sometimes I miss it. And they're just like, that was you, daddy. I'm like, oh yeah, that was me. It's cool.
Amazing, Dan. Well, I'll be sure to keep an ear out or keep an eye out on social media to see any announcements for stuff
that you're going to be doing. Check out the Dan Fogler 4D Experience podcast. That's my podcast, and a lot of cool interviews on there. And yeah, check that out. That's on Spotify and all the regular things.
Amazing. Well, Dan, thank you so much for your time. This has been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you for having me, man. Appreciate it. It's always fun to talk about the offer.
And there we have it, ladies and gentlemen, my conversation with Dan Fogler. And what a joyous time that was. I really thoroughly enjoyed chatting to Dan and could have talked to him for ages. I always say that when I interview people, but it very much is the case on this time. Very much like Patrick Gallo, who played Mario Puzo on the show. So if you haven't listened to that episode, head on back and listen to that. I think those two guys are very much two people in the entertainment industry I would love to share a bottle of wine with and just talk about movies, talk about their experiences. I would collectively love to talk to both of them for ages. And it's kind of opened my eyes doing the research of this one into Dan's comic book work, something that I kind of peripherally knew about, but it's really given me, and listening to his passion as well, talking about it, has really kind of given me a kick up the arse to check out those books. So I will be getting those on order, and I don't know, maybe in the future, maybe if Dan ever gets to play Cobra Kai, or maybe, I don't know, maybe he'll just want to come back, just me, him and Patrick come back for a chat, who knows. So as for next week on the podcast, as I said at the beginning, we're kind of just to give myself a little bit of a break as well, so I'm not recording two episodes a week, and to give this series a little bit of a shine, because it's kind of been not relegated, but it's been just released on Friday. It's been a bonus. The final three episodes plus a bonus wrap-up episode will be the next 4 weeks of programming on this podcast, all talking about The Offer. So if you haven't listened to the previous seven episodes on the feed, go back and listen to those. If you haven't watched the show, I do recommend it. It's got its flaws, and we're honest about those in our recaps and our discussions, myself and Will Chich, but I think it's fun. I think if you meet it on its level, it's a really great show. So I'll say this here now. I think I'm gonna reach out to somebody who was involved with the making of The Godfather to kind of get their impressions of the show as well, if they've been watching it. I think that would be quite fascinating. I won't say who it is yet. I always make the mistake of letting people know guests that I'm thinking of getting on, and then it doesn't come to fruition, then the egg is very much on my face. So I've learned from that, and I don't announce stuff until it's kind of in the bag, in the bank, ready to roll. So I'll do that, especially on this case, because it may not come to fruition. But yeah, if you enjoyed this episode or any other episode of the podcast, please leave a 5-star rating and review. You can do that on any podcast platform, like Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you're listening to this right now. As always, leave a message in there with what you think Bill Murray said to Scarlett Johansson at the end of Lost in Translation, as well as just some nice words about the show if you're enjoying it. It always brightens my day, and so does kind of chatting to you guys. So you can reach me on all the socials. So that is Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, Letterboxd, and TikTok, all at Caged in Pod. Nice and simple, all the same handle. You cannot forget it. Or if you'd like to drop me an email, that's always fun. You can head on over to cagedinpod@gmail.com and send me something long form. Let's have a chat. Let's have a chat. What would you like to see covered on the podcast? Let me know that. Like, obviously, I kind of hold off on certain things. I don't want to go too heavy. Earlier this year, we covered The Godfather. Maybe do we cover part two in a year? Like matching like a year later? Do we hold it later? There's so many films to go through. Is there anyone you would like to hear on the podcast, whether it's a journalist, whether it's a filmmaker, whether it's an actor, whoever? If you have any connections to anyone who's worked with the Coppola family, if you have any connections to anyone in the Coppola family themselves, please do slip into any DMs or into that inbox on my email with any leads. I'm always fascinated to talk to people. I don't know, and I think this conversation is testament to it, that I'm not too bad at these interviews. I think I'm pretty good. I think it's something I particularly enjoy. There's something fun and fascinating about interviewing people. I love doing the research. I love just getting better with it every time, and kind of, I don't know, having my idiot charm, I like to call it, when speaking to guests. And I think maybe, I don't know, it slightly endears me to them. They think, oh, this guy is passionate, but he's a bit of a goof. So, I'll open up to him. And I think that happened in this chat with Dan. If you'd like to support this show financially, head on over to patreon.com/cagedinpod. Where for as little as £1 a month, you can get some bonus content. So, as always, guys, I've been Petros Patsilibus, your guide through the crazy world of the Coppola family tree. Remember to keep it caged in, and I'll catch you next time.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
This podcast is presented by the Breadcrumbs Collective, home of the Pod Charles Cinecast, Caged In Coppola Connections, A Drooptown Limerie, Maine, Franchised, and many more to come. Our shows are all presented ad-free and made possible by listeners like you. Please support our shows by subscribing, leaving ratings and reviews, and becoming patrons at patreon.com. If you'd like to learn more about Breadcrumbs, head over to breadcrumbscollective.com.
Breadcrumbs. It's more than a podcast network. It's family.